I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Millions of low-income students depend on low-interest government-subsidized loans to help pay for their college education. The interest rate of 3.4% for those loans, called Stafford loans, could double on July 1st unless Congress and the Obama administration can reach some kind of compromise. Overall student debt today is about $1 trillion, and the default rate has been on the rise. The average debt for a college grad is about $26,000. Today on Radio Times, what will Congress and the White House do about these Stafford loans? How does all that student debt affect the overall economy? How are graduates paying off their debt? And why does college cost so much? We have two guests. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Pauline Abernathy, Vice President of the Institute of College Access and Success, where she oversees national policy and advocacy. And Pauline Abernathy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Marty.
On the telephone is Janet Lauren. She writes about higher education for Bloomberg News, focusing on college admissions and financial aid, was one of the writers at Bloomberg's Indentured Student Series that won the George Polk Award for National Reporting. And Janet Lauren, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
And let's begin, Janet, with you and also these Stafford loans. Help describe to our listeners what these loans are.
Sure. Well, if you're borrowing a federal loan, there are several different types that you can take. As an undergraduate, if you qualify for a subsidized Stafford loan, the government pays the interest while you're in school, and that's at 3.4%. If you don't qualify for a subsidized Stafford loan, you can take an unsubsidized loan, and that interest rate is at 6.8%. Some other students may qualify for a different type of federal loan called the Perkins loan that's also geared at lower-income students. That's at a 5% rate. If your parents take out loans for you, they could take out a parent-plus loan, and that's at 7.9%. And also, if you're a graduate student, you could take out a grad-plus loan, also at 7.9%. And for the plus loans, you could borrow up to the cost to attend, which means tuition, fees, housing, room and board, computer, transportation. And if you're an undergraduate taking the Stafford loans, you are limited $5,500 your first year, $6,500 your second year, and $7,500 your third and fourth year. So that's the range of federal student loans that are out there. Students can also take what's called a private loan, and those are originated either by banks or by lenders like Sallie Mae, and they don't offer the same types of protections to borrowers, such as income-based repayment or deferrals.
Well, let me turn, and my head is full of numbers there, but this is the student loan system that we have, Pauline Abernathy. Is it too complicated?
Absolutely. It needs to be simplified, and there's bipartisan agreement about that. The question is how, and that's where it is difficult.
Well, but we're talking about different levels of student people with different levels of income, so it seems to me there has to be some flexibility within a system, whether the federal system or a private system.
Absolutely, but there's a better way to balance simplicity and targeting benefits than the current system, and that's what we need to do.
Well, and let me go back to you, Janet, and this is a bit of a deja vu all over again. It seems like this time last year there was also a debate and a question about what to do about these subsidized Stafford loans. Why are these loans such an issue, I guess, of contention?
Well, this is a certain type of loan, and it's only available to undergraduates, and it's only available to those who qualify for the income limit, and the debate is only about loans that are originated starting July 1st. So if you hear a lot about this debate, you may think it's about this huge issue of student loans, but it's really a very limited type of loan. And last year, Congress passed a one-year extension of the low 3.4% interest rate. And because it was only 1 year, that is set to change to 6.8% on July 1st. And there's been a lot of debate. You know, a lot of people question, well, why is that interest rate even 6.8%? It's right. so high, especially when the cost for the government, you know, to lend is so low. And that's also part of the debate. So, you know, probably until close to July 1st, we're going to hear, you know, still a lot of talk, a lot of proposals from both sides about what could be done. You know, there is talk of tying it to the 10-year Treasury notes, perhaps a cap on the interest rate. The Senate Democrats have talked about having a 2-year rate freeze so they can, you know, come up with a better solution. But you're going to be hearing a lot about this until July 1st, likely.
Well, Pawn, let me. The current rate is 3.4%. Does that seem like a fair percent from your perspective?
Well, in today's market, it seems about right. The question is, historically, these rates have been set by Congress in an arbitrary way. There's now more and more consensus that that doesn't make sense. That's why we ended up with the rate scheduled to double, because it was something that Congress put into law many years ago. The question is, how do we move to something that is more market-based but still assures students that the rates will be affordable and are predictable and sends a clear, simple message?
What would that look like? If we have a picture of what we have today. What would that look like?
Right. Well, what my organization, TECAS, has proposed is that we have one rate and one loan for all undergraduate students that has a low interest rate that just covers the cost of lending while a student is in school, and that the rate then rises to a fixed rate when they leave school. So they know that if they leave school, their rate's going to rise. So that gives an encouragement to stay in school and complete. But the margin then that's added on covers the cost of lending, but it's a fixed percentage fixed for the life of the loan with a universal cap, so it'll never be too high. And to recognize the fact that some students come from a low-income family who, if after they graduate from school, they lose their job, they don't have the same safety net that a middle-class student a young person has to go move back in with their family, perhaps, to tide them over hard times. We would propose that students who received Pell Grants, who are low-income students, when they were in school, they would have interest-free deferments while they're unemployed. So again, you're recognizing you're having the same rates for everyone, but for low-income students who come from low-income family, if they hit hard times, they'd have interest-free deferments.
And to you, Janet Lauren, hearing what Pauline Abernathy just said, does that idea have a chance in today's political world?
Well, that's a good question. We don't really know, of course, what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks with the proposals. I think people find that student loans are confusing, and it's hard, even as a borrower, to understand exactly your terms. You know, if when you're starting school, you get new loans every year, and it's, you know, I think certainly to simplify it would be a great service to a lot of students, because there's so much confusion all over all of the interest rates, because there's, you know, so many of them. But, you know, we'll just see, you know, there's a lot of press conferences going on, a lot of rallying going on in the next few days, and we'll see what happens.
Does the government make money off these loans, Janet?
Why is there a high interest rate? It's partly because the government doesn't do underwriting like a private lender would. So some of the cost of that higher interest rate is, you know, if there are defaults, you know, certainly the government collects. My colleague John Hechinger has written extensively about debt collectors. So the government can garnish your wages, they can take away your Social Security. They are going to get their money back.
They're going to get their money back one way or another.
Yes.
Going back to you, Pauline, and there was some, I'm not sure whether news is exactly the right word, but it looked like there was some kind of movement in Washington, and obviously we're talking about a July 1st deadline, so I guess something has to be decided. You're kind of plugged in there. Any movement on this particular issue?
Well, there's certainly a lot of activity. The White House Chief of Staff is going up to meet with Democratic senators at noon today to talk about potential solutions. The House passed a proposal. The Senate tried to move to a vote but couldn't. They got a majority of senators to support a two-year freeze proposal but couldn't get the 60 votes required to stop a Republican filibuster, and so they've not been able to move to a vote.
How about from your perspective, Janet, what's the latest you hear out of Washington?
I think Pauline has really summarized it well.
That there's talk, but no compromise yet.
Yeah, no, I think we're going to be hearing a lot of talk until the end, just like last year. It came to the very, you know, to the last couple of days.
That's right.
But do you think, and even just based on last year was a presidential year, and I wonder whether that sort of changed the calculus when it came to this issue. I know that Mitt Romney was in favor of keeping these rates lower. Do you think the political environment has changed, Janet?
Well, you know, you keep hearing this $1 trillion number out there, and you also are hearing from students saying they're having a lot of difficulty paying off their loans. And as, you know, as the economy, you know, if it doesn't get better, students are struggling. And I think, you know, people are hearing that. And, you know, we hear more information about, you know, if Congress fails to act, 7 million student loan borrowers will be affected for this coming year. You know, I think there's a lot of reports certainly coming out. The New York Fed had a report recently about the impact of all this student loan debt. And, you know, certainly $1 trillion is a lot of money. You know, what happens when you graduate, you don't have a job? You know, if you're a recent graduate, you still have a six-month grace period. But I think people are hearing the struggles out there. And it's not just the students. It's also the parents who've taken out their own PLUS loans at 7.9%. And, you know, it's still a lot of money to pay back.
But, Pauline, I mean, we're a country that needs an educated populace. I mean, it seems that we should have a system that is perhaps simpler and easier and more helpful to students. If we're talking about $1 trillion worth of debt, that's a lot of debt.
Absolutely. And that's why you see Republicans and Democrats trying to come up with a solution. There was a poll out this week that showed broad support from Republicans and Democrats for keeping student loan interest rates affordable. And politicians are responding to that. They know they don't want to be the ones to be letting rates double in this kind of an environment.
So it sounds like you're saying that there will be something, a compromise, but perhaps not the draconian one that has been talked about.
Well, they're trying to come up with a compromise, but it remains to be seen. The proposal that the House passed a couple weeks ago, from our perspective, would actually cost students more than if we let rates double. And so the question is, what kind of solution can they come up with and can they agree on?
And we should talk about, and going back to you, Janet, we should talk about the fact that whatever Congress and the White House agree on, it's about future students and future loans, right?
Correct. There aren't any proposals to change interest rates retroactively. These would be all new loans that are originated beginning July 1st.
So those students that are going to be starting a new school year when September rolls around.
Correct.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Janet Lawrence, she writes about higher education for Bloomberg News. In fact, she's one of a number of reporters at Bloomberg that won the George Polk Award for National Reporting for their series called Bloomberg's Indentured Students. Also with us, Pauline Abernathy, Vice President of the Institute of College Access and Success. She oversees national policy advocacy, served previously in the as a senior advisor to Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Talking about student loans in this hour of Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Lodge Lane Assisted Living supports WHYY. Lodge Lane is now accepting reservations for their new facility located near Wilmington, Delaware. Guided by time-honored Jewish traditions and values, Lodge Lane welcomes residents of all faiths in a supportive, friendly environment with round-the-clock staffing to assist with daily tasks. Featuring a variety of floor plans and amenities that include kosher and non-kosher dining and a secure memory wing. More at 302-764-7000 or lodgelane.org.
I'm John Hockenberry of The Takeaway. The Takeaway is a fast-paced look at the news of the day. It's in-the-moment conversations that take the facts and frame them in ways that make you think. Newsmakers, experts, and people affected by the news, all part of the conversation. The talk is better when there's more at stake. So listen to The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Beginning July 2nd at noon on WHYY.
I'm Jesse Fuller. Paul Feig's career path has been rocky. The first two studio films he directed were far from successful. So, when it came time to make Bridesmaids, the stakes were high.
All through that movie, I just kept referring to it as strike three, you know, because I just knew it's either going to work or I'm going to literally be just 6 feet under after this thing.
Paul Feig and I talk about that movie and his new one, The Heat, on the next Bullseye from NPR.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about student debt, which totals close to $1 trillion. The average debt for a college or university graduate is about $26,000. We're talking about how students ended up with so much debt, what can be done to ease their loan burden, how does this debt affect the careers of young people, and, of course, the larger economy, and is higher education a good investment? Janet Lauren writes about education for Bloomberg News. Pauline Abernathy, Vice President of the Institute of College Access and Success, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Janet, your series in Bloomberg was titled "Indentured Students." Is that how you see students with college debt?
Well, it is taking them a while to pay off their debts. If you look back to the history of the loan program, which started in 1965, the idea was to give students a little bit of liquidity so they could go to college. They could borrow a little bit of money that they needed because they didn't have the cash on hand, and use that money for higher education, which often was sort of an escalator to a better life. You could get a better job. Today, the cost of college is so much higher. You know, it's increased, you know, four times the rate of inflation. So it used to be, you know, you got a summer job, you worked as a lifeguard, you earned enough money, you could pay your tuition. You know, today if you earned a job, if you had a job as a lifeguard, you might be lucky to earn enough money to buy books. And Congress has increased the loan limits. For example, we talked about how much you could borrow as an undergraduate. Mm. So that has increased. Also, there are a lot of new groups of borrowers who can take on government-backed loans. For example, in 1992, Congress allowed parents to take out parent-plus loans. So today, you know, to borrow the amount for that you're limited for the federal loan, if you're going to a much lower-priced public school, you know, you might be able to pay for some share of that. But if you're going to a private school where the total cost to attend could be over $60,000. Mm. You know, it's hard. It's hard to pay
for
that.
Well, and I wonder, Pauline, I mean, is there any research to show that the access to these loans have actually driven up the cost of higher education?
Yeah, it's.
Is there any kind of cause and effect there, do you think?
You know, the research is mixed. But it is clear that the loans do enable millions of students to attend colleges they would not otherwise be able to attend. The research is very clear that Pell Grants, which go to lower-income students, do not lead to increases in tuition and have significantly increased access to college. And that makes sense given that Pell Grants only go to the lower-income students, so there's a real reason why colleges wouldn't raise tuition based on the Pell Grants.
But I'm thinking about that young person who graduates. Let's say they have $26,000 of debt, and you hear of mm-hmm. Many times more that amount of debt, and you go into this job market and you want to start your career, you want to start your job life, mm-hmm. And you're saddled with a lot of debt.
Yeah. No, there's no question that graduating with debt, and particularly with significant debt, can affect your decisions about career, starting a family, buying a home, saving for your retirement. So there's no question about that. On the other hand, college is still, on average, a terrific investment. And it's not just how much you borrow, but mm-hmm. how you borrow. And as Janet mentioned, there are both federal loans and there are private loans. And paying for college with a private loan is a bit like paying for college with a credit card. These typically have variable interest rates that are highest for those who can least afford it, and they don't come with any of the protections that federal student loans do. Most significantly, federal student loans, you can repay them as a share of your income. That's a new program called income-based repayment that's been available mm-hmm. since 2009. And so it means for students who have federal student loans, if they want to go into a lower-paying public service position or they want to start their own business, they're payments will never be more than they can afford. If your income is low enough or you have no income, you pay nothing at all until your income rises again, and then your payments rise as your income rises. So again, it's providing that assurance that your payments will be manageable, and then after 20 or 25 years, any balance remaining is forgiven by the government.
Wow. I was also reading about pay as you go. Is that, or pay as you earn,
right.
I should say. Is that what you're talking about?
Pay as you earn is a variation on income-based repayment that the Obama administration created for current students and recent college graduates who were entering the job market during the recession, during a really tough time. And so it's a provides slightly more generous benefits than the current income-based repayment program. So it caps the monthly payments at a lower rate, and it provides forgiveness after 20 years rather than 25 years.
You want to add to that, Janet?
Well, it's a key difference between federal loans and private loans. I did a story last summer about private loans, and students said they didn't really quite understand the difference. They thought they were just taking out a student loan. But as it turns out, they didn't have the fixed rates of a federal loan, and their interest rates could balloon higher than 10%.
Wow.
So these are the types of students who really got themselves in trouble with, way more than the average amount borrowed. I had a couple of students who had private loan debt in the hundreds of over $100,000, and they just didn't understand what they were getting themselves into. And before 2008, it was much easier to get a private loan. I had one young man quoted in my story. He got it over the internet. It was like signing up for iTunes. And the lending requirements have been tightened up, and often now you will need a co-signer, often a parent, to get one of those private loans.
Are we talking about people misleading, college students and their families, or just it's so confusing and complicated to try to figure out these loan systems?
Well, it is very confusing, people say they just didn't really understand what they were signing up for. And a private loan is, again, not originated by the government. If you're a first-generation student, you've never been to college, you just may not know the subtleties. And, hopefully you will ask in your financial aid office to help you to understand a very complicated system. Things have gotten, the underwriting has changed. So I don't think you could just sign up on the internet anymore for a private loan.
I was reading, though, that the default rate has been going up or certainly did rise in recent years, Janet, and then I'll put that to you, Pauline, and then we'll get to our callers.
Yes, it has been rising for the federal loans. And I actually saw something recently that it has been going down for private loans.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason is because the lenders are just being more cautious who they're giving credit to. And, again, they may offer a much higher interest rate if you're not credit worthy.
And do you think the default rate has gone up because people can't find jobs? I mean, is it employment related, do you think?
That would certainly be a huge factor.
What do you think, Pauline?
Absolutely. When the economy hits a rough patch, you always see the default rates rise. So that is clearly a factor. But at this point, now that we have income-based repayment and that all federal student loans are eligible for income-based repayment, we shouldn't see so many borrowers defaulting when they could. If they were aware of income-based repayment, they could take advantage of that and keep their payments manageable.
And do they have to sign up for that?
To sign up for it. That's exactly right. And we've been working with the Department of Education to make it much easier, but still much more needs to be done to reach out to borrowers and let them know that it exists. Most borrowers don't know that it exists. We've recommended that for borrowers who are more than 6 months delinquent, so they haven't made a payment in 6 months, they should automatically be put in income-based repayment because the consequences of default are so severe for borrowers. It's important to avoid.
When you get out of college, keeping track of all your loans could be extremely confusing because you have different loans every year, so it's not like you're getting one bill. You may have a loan serviced by one of several different government agencies. If you have one private loan in there, it's a completely different system. You can't log in on your federal student loan account and see that. you know, if you've moved around a lot, you know, young people, you know, maybe they get a job in one city and they move to another city. If you haven't kept all of your information updated, and you may just not know that you have this loan from this servicer, you don't pay it, you could be in default. So I did a story about Perkins loans defaults, and those are loans at aimed at lower income students, and they are originated by actually your college. And students were being sued by their college when they defaulted. And, you know, you talk to students and they just may not have realized that they were getting this additional loan and it's serviced by somebody else. And it's all very confusing, and you just have to be very well organized to keep track of every single loan you have.
And default, I'm assuming that affects people's credit rating. And what I'm hearing from you, Janet, is that in certain instances, someone could be sued if they default on a student loan.
Yes, it does affect your credit rating, and yes, colleges, right, you know, may sue you if you haven't repaid that Perkins loan, because it's a revolving loan fund. And, you know, if John Smith doesn't repay his loan, then the college can't make a loan next year, you know, to Susie Smith.
You want, and you're nodding your head, Pauline. Anything you want to add to that, and then we'll get to our callers.
No, absolutely. In fact, for federal student loans, as Janet alluded, the government will collect. And in fact, it can garnish your wages, your tax refunds. If you haven't paid by the time you're receiving Social Security, they can even garnish your Social Security. So it's important to take advantage of these different repayment options that are available, because ignoring them leads to default and to these consequences. In addition to income-based repayment, there's also something that was created at the same time called public service loan forgiveness. And what it means is for those borrowers who go into public service, which is defined as working for a nonprofit or a government agency, and make payments for 10 years while they're in those jobs, they'll have any balance remaining forgiven after just 10 years rather than the 20 or 25. But again, you have to make sure you've got the right type of loans, you're in the right type of plan. So people do need to ask their servicer, or go to the Department of Education's website, or go to our website, ibrinfo.org, and learn about these plans to make sure that they'll qualify.
And that's Pauline Abernathy. She's Vice President of the Institute of College Access and Success, joining us here in our Philadelphia studios. And on the line, Janet Lauren. She writes about higher education for Bloomberg News, focusing on college admissions and financial aid. We are talking about student debt, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Brian from Germantown. Brian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, Marty. How you doing? Morning to you and your guests. You know, the $26,000 average, when you go to a school that costs $20,000 a year over 4 years, that's way more than average. I have a son who owes $70,000 right now. He graduated. He's paying it back, and the loan company do not want to work with him. He put it into deferment, and what they did was change his interest rate and change the time when he has to pay. I want to kick back the end. Is there any way that it, and this is a private loan, Sallie Mae, and I'm not scared to call the company, and come to find out that the school had geared these students into getting this program and got a kickback from these loan companies.
Wow.
Now, is there anywhere we let the listeners know what we can do about these type of corrupted agencies and loan programs? And if the federal government can institute a program like the mortgage help that they give people for mortgage for private loans.
Robert, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm going to toss that first to you, Pauline, but Jenna, I'd like to hear from you as well. Go ahead.
The issue around kickbacks is a real one. Congress did crack down on this arrangements between colleges and lenders, where the colleges were getting a share of revenue for their students taking out these private loans. Congress stepped in to prevent that. There was just an article out this morning, though, saying the Department of Education hasn't been enforcing that law.
Oh, really?
So that is something we do. Congress needs to insist that the Department of Education enforce the law to prevent that kind of practice. But we also need to provide relief like to people like this man's son, who was the victim of that kind of a kickback, if that's indeed what happened. And in fact, there'll be a hearing in the Senate Banking Committee next Tuesday on exactly this issue of what can be done to help the millions of borrowers who have private loans, many of whom were, deceptively or misled into taking them out, and now are struggling to repay and not being provided with the kind of flexibility right. They need in order to do so.
And as Robert said, his son has loans of $70,000. Janet, you want to weigh in on that as well?
Yeah, I was actually about to mention the hearing on Tuesday. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is the government agency that is charged with overseeing private student loans, has been looking into this issue to try to help borrowers, get some sort of rehabilitation. You've made consistent payments, perhaps trying to help borrowers get a lower interest rate, because as we talked about, these private student loans don't have fixed interest rates, and they can, increase to over 10%. The number of originations for private loans continues to increase, and perhaps part of the reason students are having to take so much money out in private loans is the cost of college keeps rising, and if you're only allowed to take out $5,500 in federal loans and, you go to a college that doesn't give you enough financial aid to bridge that gap, you may seek a private loan. So perhaps that's why people are seeing that still as a market, is because the cost of college continues to get even more expensive. You can only take out a limited amount as an undergraduate for a government loan. Are you going to see more people looking to private loans? I think the loan companies would be very happy if that were the case.
Thanks for the call. Janet, let me toss something back to you. I mean, are people looking at the idea of loans being contingent on a college or university that they have to meet certain levels of performance standards?
Well, really the only thing the colleges are on the hook for is what's called the cohort default rate. And for a college to lose federal loan access, they would have to be 25% or higher for 3 years in a row. And that's unlikely to happen for nonprofit colleges. There's been a lot of talk about in the for-profit sector, which Pauline could certainly talk more about. But you talk to experts out there. Certainly, colleges hire companies to talk with students and say, "Well, you could defer your loan," and then that takes them out of that cohort default rate danger.
Well, and we're almost up in a break here, but I was thinking about tying it, Pauline, to graduation rates or something, that a college would have a responsibility to help a student graduate.
Yeah, people have proposed things like that. It's you don't want to do it in such a way that then push students through just for the purpose of doing that rather than ensuring that they're getting a meaningful degree. But you're right, colleges should have more skin in the game. And currently, the standards are way too lax. And they should, if their default rates are high and rising, there should be some consequences for them. And likewise, they should be rewarded if their default rates are dropping.
And that's Pauline Abernathy, who joins us along with Janet Lauren. And we are talking about student loans and default rates and the responsibilities of government to try to address this issue, colleges, families, students as well. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Coming to WHYY's Hamilton Public Media Commons, our popular Young Journalist Summer Camp for students in grades 9 through 12. Learn from the staff of WHYY's renowned news department, create video news stories, and work with the media instructors of the award-winning Hamilton Commons. Learn all aspects of production, interviewing, shooting and editing video, and more. Two-week sessions start June 24th and August 5th. RSVP at whyy.org/camps.
How was the Obama campaign able to beat Mitt Romney in 2012? Journalist Jonathan Alter says it was in part by ignoring the human desire not to be irritating with online fundraising appeals. On the next Fresh Air, Alter talks about what he calls the most consequential election of recent times. His new book is The Center Holds. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Supreme Court rulings,
the Boston Marathon bombings,
presidential press conferences. The news does not stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. Starting July 1st, you'll be able to hear the NPR news you rely on in the middle of your day.
And I am delighted to welcome Jeremy Hobson as my new co-host.
Here and now.
Don't miss a thing.
Weekdays at 1, beginning July 1st on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In this hour of the show, we are talking about what can be done in Washington to ease the student loan burden and how student loan debt is affecting the lives of young people and the larger economy. And again, our guests are Pauline Abernathy of the Institute for College Access and Success and Janet Lauren from Bloomberg News. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Robert from media to join our conversation. Robert, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
Thanks. Great show.
Thank you.
Quick comment and a question. I mean, I have three children, each of whom have graduated graduate schools, professional schools, each of whom have well over $100,000 in total debt made up of 30 or 40 odd loans, as your guests portrayed earlier. But the point I want to make is that in many ways, it seems to me the financial aid offices of these schools are complicit in this problem. First of all, they frame loans as gifts. You get a congratulations letter when you get it. The so-called counseling that you have to do to get the loans is the most inane five questions with some online questions. And if you get it wrong, it says, no, the answer is B. Now, what's the answer? Wow. And in a sense, I think that the system almost encourages students to maximize their debt load in order to pay for, let's say, single apartments or anything, because it all seems like a giant gift. And I can't imagine another transaction in our economic lives where such unsophisticated borrowers enter the system with no one as their advocate. It seems as if the school, the lender, are both basically together trying to get you to borrow this money so that you can take on this kind of debt to this kind of education. And look, my kids have got great educations, and they got access because of this, but the amount of loan repayments are staggering, and I think had they had some guidance when they took out the loans, they would have borrowed less and budgeted more.
Oh,
and there is not a soul in the financial aid offices that seem to be on the student side when this transaction goes through, and I'll take
Robert, it's a very interesting call. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Janet, can I toss that to you? A little bit of a theme from what we heard from our first caller as well.
Sure. I did a story about a year ago about the confusion over financial aid award letters, and your caller is absolutely right. Sometimes you read this letter and it sounds like amazing. I'm getting such a great gift, and you read the fine print and you realize that, well, they're packaging loans, but it sounds like it's a grant, and a grant you don't have to pay back. In fact, some colleges, one of the examples that I had in that story was from Drexel, and it packaged, in the financial aid award letter, a $36,000 either a parent loan or a private loan for the family to take, and that isn't a gift, and you have to be really savvy to understand it. And it is hard, and my best advice is to ask a lot of questions of the financial aid office. You know, ask somebody to sit down with you. What does this mean? Do I have to pay this back? Is it a loan or is it a grant?
Basic kinds of questions. Pauline, do you want to add to that, Pauline?
Just absolutely. It is a huge problem. There's actually bipartisan legislation in the Senate to require a standard award letter format that would distinguish loans from grants and make it easy for families to compare these offers on an apples-to-apples basis. Until we have that, there's only in a voluntary standard format that some schools are using, but not all schools. Mm-hmm. So we need to have a standard format to make it easy to compare offers. Until then, as Janet said, people should ask questions. If a school isn't answering your question, that's a red flag. Walk away. If they're rushing you, that's another red flag. And if they're saying you have to take out a private loan, you know, look around, because there are colleges out there that are going to be more affordable for you and will not require a private loan.
I wonder, Janet, whether you've also looked at the fact that, and we've got had callers, one graduate having $70,000, another having, it sounds like, more than $100,000 worth of loans. Is this a drag on the overall U.S. economy? If people are busy paying back loans, are they not then buying cars or buying houses or paying for things that seem to drive so much of the economy?
A short answer, yes. That's exactly what is happening. So if you have a student loan payment of a couple of $100 per month, or even higher if you have $100,000 of loans, it's going to be more, you're not able to save up for the mortgage or the house that you're dreaming of, or the car. The New York Fed has actually had some really interesting data on this. And also, what happens when interest rates go up in a year or so? What happens to the share of money that you have? You know, you're going to have your student loan payment is still going to be several hundred dollars. Mm. It is a big drag on the economy. And I should add, it's not just for the students; it's for the parents who've also borrowed. About 10 to 15% of that $1 trillion is parents who have taken out money for their kids. Either they've co-signed as a parent. As a private loan, or they've taken out PLUS loans, which have an interest rate of 7.9%, which is really high.
Sure. Let me see what Peter from Why I'm Missing has to say. Peter, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'll try to be excellent comments, excellent questions. I'll try not to repeat. People have to realize, in a way, it's almost worse than what they're hearing, because it's very like the mortgage situation. These loans, the private loans at least, are bundled. They're sold in the market. They even have a name for it. It's called tranches. And they're by high-sounding groups, something collegiate trust and so forth. They all sound very mortarboardish. In fact, one of them has a mortarboard for their emblem. But when it comes down to it, understand, the aunt, the uncle, the parent, the co-signed, they're the real target. People don't care about a student when they pay it back as a barista. They're almost happier when they go in default, because then they're after mom and dad's property. And because it's secured, they're very marketable. I would like to make a few suggestions. Because of this, if you are a student or parent or aunt or uncle, you're being hounded, ask them, if they're not the original bank or whoever made the loan, where is your assignment? Because just like mortgages, you have all these people calling up and saying, oh, we have your paper. Oh, you do? Show me the assignment.
Peter, hold on just one second, because you raise an interesting point, and I'm looking straight at Pauline Abernathy just to get her response. But hold on one second.
Yeah, no, he's absolutely right. What we saw before the financial crisis is, the lenders were pushing these private loans on students because there was demand in the financial market for them, just like we saw with mortgages. And now 90% of private loans do have a cosigner, and that cosigner is absolutely on the hook, just as he says. Now, one change that has happened since the financial crisis is the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And they were given authority over all of private loans. Before, there was no one entity that had oversight over private loans, and there was no real place for consumers to go. Now there is. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is taking complaints. Mm. They've helped borrowers get relief from their lender, including financial relief. So if you have a question or a concern, or you believe your lender is not being fair, or have other questions about what's going on, contact the CFPB. They have an 800 number, and their website is cfpb.gov or consumerfinance.gov, and you can submit your complaints online. So they are there for you and is a place for you to turn.
And Peter, give us one more of your comments, and then I'll put that to Janet.
That's excellent. Also, if you care about this, understand, because it's such a big deal for the financial industry, their lobbyists are out. If you care about this, you must not only call but write. Last but not least, if you are a service person, you are protected by the Soldiers, Sailors, Relief Act. Use it. Don't give in to these people.
Peter, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I would just add that's another area where the Consumer Financial Protection put out a report showing that service members have protections given to them by law, and the servicers are not giving them to them, or they're actually actively misleading them about what their rights are. So again, if you have any questions or uncertainty, contact the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They have an Office of Student Affairs and they have an Office of Veteran Affairs and Service Member Affairs headed by Holly Petraeus, and they're very active and aggressive on this issue.
Janet, you want to add to that?
Well, as we've talked about a little bit before, there is a private loan market, and you do have... If you do have a loan from Sallie Mae, you know, it is likely that Sallie Mae originated it. But there is also Sallie Mae and other private lenders used to originate federal loans, and that is a little bit of a distinction. So before July of 2010, private lenders originated government loans, and often those were the ones that were securitized. So again, we go back to the servicers. You could have two different Sallie Mae loans, and one could actually be a government loan, and another one taken out a few years ago could be backed by Sallie Mae. Hmm. So that's another point of confusion with all of these different types of loans.
Janet, would it be fair to say that the expansion of financial loans has led to an increase in for-profit colleges? Is there, again, a kind of a cause and effect when we look at that phenomenon?
I'm going to hand that one to Pauline. That's her area of expertise.
Go ahead, Pauline.
Well, you know, there is history right after the GI Bill was created. We saw a lot of fly-by-night for-profit colleges emerge to take advantage of the GI Bill dollars, and Congress cracked down. And then over time, those laws were weakened, and we saw an emergence. Right now, we're in another era where the companies lobbied Congress and weakened the rules, and they're now, you know, for-profit colleges used to be mom-and-pop schools. Now, three-quarters of the students attending for-profit colleges are attending colleges that are publicly traded or owned by private equity, and so they have lots of money, and they aggressively use it to lobby Congress and the Department of Education to loosen accountability rather than strengthen it. And to the administration's credit, they are just initiating a new rulemaking process to try and ensure that the programs that are receiving GI Bill dollars and federal student loans and Pell Grants are actually providing students and preparing them for careers, if that's what they're marketing them as
real
doing.
Careers.
Real
right.
careers. And that if they're just leaving students consistently with debts they can't repay, that they will lose eligibility for federal student aid.
Let me see. Go ahead, Lori.
I will add that if you look at the stock prices of a lot of those for-profit companies, they have gone down considerably, and their enrollments are going down. So that is a response to all of the oversight in the proposed regulation that has been discussed in years about the for-profit sector.
Let me see what Ann from East Falls has to say. Ann, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm calling in regard to the forgiveness on student loans after you've given 10 years of public service. Mm-hmm. I heard on a financial show that the amount that is forgiven, that the student would have to pay a gift tax on that, and I don't know if that's true or not.
Well, and I'm looking at you, Pauline.
It's not true under the public service loan forgiveness. It's not treated as taxable income. Under current law, the forgiveness under income-based repayment would be considered taxable income. That's something that we are actively working with members of Congress on both sides of the aisle to fix. It was never intended. They agree on that. But it's, again, a question of getting the legislation so to fix that. But no one will be eligible for income-based repayment forgiveness for a few years, so we have some time for that. For public service loan forgiveness, you don't have to worry about that.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times to see what Dana from Germantown has to say. And Dana, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I graduated in 2006 with over $60,000 in student loans. I have a professional career, but most of the programs that I've been hearing about in the show are for recent graduates. And I was wondering if there's any kind of program to help people who graduated you know, a while ago to help manage the loans.
And what percent are you paying, Dana?
Around 4%.
And this is about Pauline.
Yeah. So income-based repayment is available for all federal student loans, so regardless of when you graduated. So if your debt, you know, roughly a rule of thumb is if your amount owed is greater than your annual income, you'll likely benefit from income-based repayment, and it will lower your monthly payments. You know, as with a mortgage, if you're paying a lower monthly payment, it can lead to higher overall debt service, but it keeps your monthly payments low, and that's why the forgiveness after 20 or 25 years is so important, so that you're not paying when you should be saving for retirement. You can find out again by going to the Education Department's website or www.ibrinfo.org and learn about IBR Info.
Janet, you want to add anything to that?
No, I think she summarized it well.
It's so interesting because, and call me naive, but when you think about the idea of wanting a system to educate people in this country, especially in this information age that we're in, it seems that in many ways this should be a win-win for everybody. And yet it just, frankly, Janet, doesn't feel that way.
Well, again, if you look at the original intent of the federal loan program in 1965, you know, it was meant to give you a little bit of liquidity. It wasn't meant to give you a second mortgage, and that's sort of where the idea of indentured students came from. You know, Bill Ford used that, the former congressman used that term something like 20 years ago.
Wow.
And it wasn't meant to have a couple of $100,000 in student loans. Now, granted, it's very rare if you graduate from college with such a high amount of debt like that. Either you got in trouble with a private loan, or more likely you've gone to graduate school. And graduate school is certainly more expensive, and there isn't as much financial aid offered in graduate school like there is for college. I did a story about medical student debt a couple of months ago, and the average debt for someone who finishes medical school is $170,000. And that also includes money borrowed for college, but that's a lot of money, and especially if you're going into primary care, where you're not earning as much, you know, it's a real decision you have to make.
Well, on that note, we have to end our conversation. Janet Lauren, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And she writes about higher education for Bloomberg News. And Pauline Abernathy, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
And she's vice president of the Institute of College Access and Success. And thank you for those phone calls as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, archives, email. I'm Artie Moskowain. Do stay with us for the second hour. We'll be right back.